It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Caitlin Harrop, in for Ben Kiefer. Governor Kim Reynolds announced plans yesterday to partially reopen certain businesses in 77 counties across the state starting this Friday. The decision is the governor's strongest move towards loosening social distancing measures, but follows decisions last week to lift restrictions on elective surgeries and farmers markets. These changes come as cases of COVID-19 continue to climb across the state. With me now to dive deeper into these changes is Iowa Public Radio health reporter Natalie Krebs. Natalie, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Caitlin.
Natalie, you were monitoring the governor's conference yesterday. Tell us what happened.
Yeah, so Governor Kim Reynolds said she's going to allow restaurants, retail stores, malls to partially open in 77, mostly rural counties. So this means they can reopen, but they can only take 50% of their occupancy capacity. So 50% of the customers that they can normally take. So if you have 100 people who can fit in your restaurant, you can take 50. She's chosen these 77 counties as places that have either no confirmed cases or very few confirmed cases to reopen. And then additionally, that will be starting this Friday. So 77 counties will be able to partially reopen some of their businesses starting Friday, May 1st. And then she said for the additional 22 counties, those restaurants and all those businesses will remain closed until at least May 15th.
So these businesses in the 77 counties, again, 22 are excluded, including Lynn, Polk, Johnson, Woodbury, Black Hawk, Tama, and Louisa counties, among others. These businesses that could reopen, only able to function at 50% capacity. When we think about businesses like malls or large restaurants, this seems like something that could be difficult to enforce. What does the governor have to say about the enforcement aspect of it?
Yeah, so the governor is putting a lot of emphasis on personal responsibility. So she's really just sort of asking restaurants and retail stores and malls that are able to open to kind of do the right thing and really to make sure that their tables or areas are properly socially distant, that they are really limiting the number of customers that come in, that they're really taking precautions, even though they can partially reopen.
Natalie, are there any travel restrictions in place? Is there anything that could prevent someone from, say, driving from one of the 22 counties excluded from the list to a nearby county with more open businesses to shop or eat or work out at a gym?
No. So again, Governor Reynolds hasn't said that she's putting any travel restrictions in place. Again, she has a big emphasis on personal responsibility. So she's asking people who are older, who have underlying health conditions, who have symptoms to stay home. So she's saying stay home if you're sick, no matter where you are. Don't go out, even if you are in a county where some of the closures are being reopened, where some of the restrictions are being lifted. But for the most part, yeah, there's going to be like no travel restrictions, no enforcement of being able to travel county to county.
This call to reopen businesses comes as COVID-19 continues to spread across the state. On Saturday alone, 647 new cases were reported. That was a record one-day increase for reported cases in the state. How did Governor Reynolds explain her decision to significantly loosen restrictions amid record cases?
Yeah, so she said that they are... the counties that will remain closed are the counties that are hotspots. So we're looking at some of the more populated counties in the state, which includes Polk and Lynn County. Also counties that are known to have outbreaks. So Louisa County, Tama County, both very rural, but both have been the sites of huge outbreaks from meatpacking facilities and long-term care facilities. So her rationale is just sort of she is keeping the counties where there are known outbreaks closed, and then she's opening the counties where there have just been few confirmed cases and then kind of no growth in cases in the last 14 days.
Natalie, what have you heard from healthcare officials and experts since Governor Reynolds spoke yesterday?
So, yeah, there are some health experts are kind of say they're concerned about reopening the state. And some of the biggest concerns are the fact that there still is a lack of testing across the state. Now, Iowa last week announced that it will be launching a Test Iowa initiative, which will be 6 drive-through sites throughout the state. One opened in Des Moines last weekend, but we still don't quite know where those other 5 sites are going to be. And that eventually will be an increase of about 3,000 tests a day. But, you know, it's still pretty limited, and testing has been limited to outbreak areas. They've sent a number of tests to where meatpacking plants have outbreaks. But for some of these rural counties, testing rates are pretty low. So, you know, we still really don't know where cases are. And that's what health experts say they're concerned about, is that we still just don't know how many cases are out there. And then also, you know, the state is still hiring people to do contact tracing, which is another thing health experts say is really necessary to contain the spread of the virus. And Iowa is still kind of in the process of hiring those contact tracers. It's sort of unknown how far they are in that process. So health experts have expressed concerns about reopening part of the state because of this. Also, it is a concern, too, that some of these counties that are opening are right next to some of the counties that are hotspots that will remain closed. And so with you know, out travel restrictions, it's sort of, there is a concern that, you know, it could spread.
As businesses reopen around the state, Natalie, what does this mean for workers? What will that look like to head back to work?
Basically, Iowa Workforce Development yesterday issued guidelines saying, for Iowans whose employers recall them back to work, you know, who they reopen, they will lose their unemployment benefits unless they fall into some specific categories. And those categories include if you've tested positive for COVID-19, if someone in your household has tested positive for COVID-19, or even if you've lost transportation, transportation or childcare from COVID-19, then you'll be excluded. You'll be able to continue collecting your unemployment benefits. But if you're just concerned about going back to work because of the COVID-19 outbreak, then it's possible you could lose your unemployment benefits as employers start to reopen and if you are offered your job back.
Many of the counties set to be part of this partial reopening lean rural. You've reported on that, Natalie, and what you call a possible sense of false security in some rural counties where identified cases of COVID-19 have been relatively low. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so this goes back to again, testing is how has been restricted, you know, so a lot of these rural counties, you've residents haven't fallen into testing restrictions in the past. And so the concern is sort of that a lot of, you know, cases are undiagnosed in these rural counties. The other issue is sort of, you know, people in rural areas think they're sort of like naturally socially distanced. I think that there can be a tendency to feel, you know, a little bit safer than in more densely populated rural areas. It was interesting, a University of Texas at Austin study that came out earlier this month looked at Zika virus data from a couple of years ago and found that if there's, you know, one confirmed case in a rural county, then the chances that there's sort of an undetected outbreak go up to 51%. You know, on top of that, the concern is, you know, if there is an outbreak in some of these rural areas, you're looking at places that have a critical access hospital that has limited ICU beds, limited staffing, people who work in rural healthcare, that number has been declining for years. So it could really be catastrophic for rural areas if they do sort of have an undetected outbreak.
Testing is still limited here in Iowa, but last week, Governor Reynolds announced the new testiowa.com, an initiative aimed at expanding COVID-19 testing through partnership with a private testing company in Utah. What do you know about the possible impact of this new initiative and the company the state is working with to make it happen?
The state is working with a Utah-based company to provide, they have a contract to provide 500,000 tests in the next year. And so they're hoping to get up to 3,000 tests a day. So far, last weekend, they opened the Des Moines drive-through location downtown. That's been the only one that's been open so far. I think they did about 200 tests last weekend. And then they're supposed to be opening 5 sites across the state. So Iowans are supposed to go to testiowa.com, do an assessment. The state government has said so far that they are using that data to figure out where they're going to be opening additional testing sites. But right now, we're not quite sure where those other 5 sites are going to be. So that is something that's supposed to increase testing capabilities in the state.
This longer list of partial reopenings came yesterday, and it's set to go into effect on Friday. But last week, Governor Reynolds announced that elective surgeries would be able to resume starting on Monday. What have you heard from hospitals and clinics regarding this lifted restriction, Natalie?
Yeah, I think hospitals and clinics around the state are, you know, working to get elective surgeries back on board. I know that UIHC has said that they're going to start doing elective surgeries again. The restrictions in place are that, you know, hospitals have to have their own supply of PPE to be able to do this. They're not supposed to be taking, or they're not able to take personal protective equipment from the state stockpile. And so that's something that I know that health providers are working at doing to try to restart elective surgeries again after Reynolds announced last Friday that they'd be able to do that.
Midwestern states, including Wisconsin, Minnesota, and Illinois, have planned to work together for an orchestrated response to COVID-19. Iowa hasn't been included in that group, but Governor Reynolds says she's been speaking with governors in the region, including Nebraska and as far away as Wyoming. Earlier this month, Governor Reynolds also referred to the White House as a partner in working to reopen the state. What do you know about how Iowa is working with other states or the federal government with response to COVID-19 right now?
So Governor Reynolds has sort of indicated that she's really working with, you know, Nebraska, North Dakota, South Dakota, some of the states' governors that she's had previous relationships with. When asked about, you know, the Midwest partnership that includes Minnesota and Illinois and a number of other states, I think 7 states total, she said that she's worked with the Illinois governor in the past. She sort of didn't really indicate, you know, to what extent she's working with him now. So it's sort of unclear, you know. She is definitely working with a Nebraska governor, and he too is launching a Test Nebraska initiative that's similar to the one here in Iowa. But it's sort of unclear how she's, you know, working with some of the other partners, including Minnesota and Illinois and Wisconsin that do border the state.
All right. Natalie Krebs, Iowa Public Radio health reporter. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Caitlin.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Caitlin Harrop, in for Ben Kiefer. As the new coronavirus continues to spread across the nation and state, several rural meatpacking communities have seen a staggering increase in confirmed cases. This is true in Loayza County, home to Columbus Junction and a Tyson pork processing plant. Earlier this month, the county was reported to have one of the highest rates of COVID-19 transmission in the country. The plant closed for 2 weeks, but resumed limited operations last week. Joining us now to offer more information on the state of COVID-19 in Columbus Junction is Columbus Junction Mayor Mark Houston. Mayor Houston, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome. Good to talk to you.
So Columbus Junction has a population of just over 1,800 people. Loayza County more broadly has seen more than 260 confirmed cases of COVID-19, according to our most recent numbers on Monday afternoon. How concerned are you about this number of cases and the rate of infection?
Well, I think we're in an unusual situation. Again, a small town and a small county. I know I used to kind of use the example, even with unemployment, when you deal in small numbers, a few changing one way or the other from a percentage standpoint makes a pretty big difference. Now, again, that many tests or positive results, you know, you don't like it. You'd like to have none. But, you know, the part of it too is the number of tests that have been performed here is probably higher per capita too than a lot of places, so that there can be some distortion in all of that, but still there has been a lot.
And a significant portion of these cases have been connected to the Tyson plant in your city. The plant, as we said, closed down for 2 weeks but has since reopened. Do you have concerns about the safety of the workers at the plants at this time and their families?
I don't know as I have. I think you have concern for everybody. You have a concern for everybody countrywide. I went through the plant, I think it was last week, after the company had done the improvements out there. I hope the company is trying everything they can do to protect their workers, it looks like to me. But this is kind of an unusual disease, I guess. And, you know, whether it'll be successful or not, I guess a little time is going to tell here. But, I think that Tyson in our particular plant has tried to protect the workers, it looks like to me, as best they can. And we'll just have to wait and see.
Have you asked them to take any additional protective measures since their initial shutdown for 2 weeks?
I don't have any authority over Tyson.
Right.
So I have not asked them to do anything.
Have you heard concerns more broadly in the community about the state of COVID-19 in Columbus Junction? What are you hearing in kind of your daily mayoral work?
Of course, our town is just like every other town in the country. I haven't been around very many people. I guess I read the news articles and listen to the news. I just came from City Hall. The doors, are locked. Our employees are there working on normal city function things. Our streets are quiet. Again, just like probably every other community throughout the country. I guess I'm not seeing anything hugely different here than it was a month ago.
Mayor Houston, no hospital exists in Louisa County. Do you have concerns about health care in Columbus Junction as COVID-19 continues to spread and access to support that people might need?
Not really. We have a community health service here. We also have Mercy Services here. We have Washington County Hospital, which is about 20 minutes away. We have Muscatine Hospital, which is probably 20 minutes away. And we have everything that's in Iowa City that's probably 30 minutes away. So, as far as getting to medical, I bet people in Columbus Junction can get to the Mercy Hospital quicker than some people that live in Iowa City. I've lived here my whole life. I guess that's never been a concern before.
You mentioned testing earlier. What testing resources are currently available in Columbus Junction?
There seems to be different kinds of tests from what I understand in the news media. I think the tests that we're afforded here, I think, are, whatever it was that the state of Iowa and the governor sent this way that were used at least for Tyson personnel at Tyson. And then there were some of the tests sent to the community health service. And they, have been testing people. But again, I think the tests are, as far as I know, I can't just walk up and say, I would like to have a test for the virus. You have to have symptoms and other things just like any place else in the country.
For those who have COVID-19 in Columbus Junction, what resources are available? Is there anything that the city is doing to support those who may be in need right now?
Well, I take it, as far as I know, from the description of it, it's a respiratory disease. I guess, the people do what the doctor tells them to do, I hope. I don't know as the city there's anything that the city could do or should do, really. We're not in the medical business, so.
Sure. I know some communities have taken steps to help with self-isolation for people who may have COVID-19. Are there any steps such as that that's being taken?
No.
On Monday, Governor Reynolds announced plans to allow for the partial reopening of some businesses in 77 counties in the state. Louisa County was excluded from this list. Do you hope to see businesses reopen in the county and in Columbus Junction soon? And if so, do you have a plan for how you could perhaps help Columbus Junction businesses do so safely when the time comes?
Well, I think that I would hope that everybody wants these businesses to open as soon as is safe. And, you know, I would think, you know, the city, if anything else, will just encourage people to do the things that are being recommended as businesses help, you know, with be sanitary and masks and all those kinds of things. Again, I know with the city, we've, at least at City Hall, we've talked about it a little bit. You know, I think a lot of it just depends on what kind of a business it is. And then again, what the governor and others really suggest as far as doing it the safe way.
All right, Mark Houston, he is the mayor of Columbus Junction. That is a part-time position that he has held for 3 years. Mayor Houston, thank you for joining us.
Yep, thank you very much.
After the break, more than 10 million people across the country are victims of intimate partner violence every year. I'll talk with Lindsay Pingle, Director of Community Engagement at the Iowa Coalition Against Domestic Violence, about what it means to distribute invaluable domestic violence survivor services in the time of a pandemic. We'll talk about social distancing in the state's 6 brick-and-mortar shelters, mobile services, and what other resources are available.
Our services are still available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week to anyone who is in need. So when we look at our shelters and what we're seeing right now, you know, we're really following guidelines from the CDC and kind of what's being told at the state and federal level in terms of social distancing, not having groups of more than 10 in a space at one time, making sure that all communal living spaces, you know, are adequately disinfected, regulating, you know, how many people are possibly, you know, in a kitchen area or a communal living room or bathrooms.
Later in the hour, Linn County Auditor and Commissioner of Elections Joel Miller joins the conversation. We'll discuss options for voting by mail ahead of the June primary. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Caitlin Harrop, back in just a moment. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Caitlin Harrop, in for Ben Kiefer. Nearly 20 people experience intimate partner violence each minute in the United States, and 1 in 3 women and 1 in 4 men have experienced some form of violence by an intimate partner in their lifetime. With social distancing in effect and movement limited, the COVID-19 pandemic is providing increased challenges to domestic violence service organizations across the state, and in some cases, to those seeking support as well. With me now is Lindsay Pingle, Director of Community Engagement for the Iowa Coalition Against Domestic Violence, an organization which provides services to over 41,000 survivors of domestic violence through 23 programs across the state last year. Lindsay, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Caitlin.
The Iowa Coalition Against Domestic Violence provides services through a variety of means, including your 6 physical shelters in the state. I understand that these shelters are all still up and running. So what steps are you taking to ensure that these spaces are healthy and safe for your clients during this time?
Yes, absolutely. That's the first thing I want to make sure your listeners know is that our services are still available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week to anyone who is in need. So just to give you a little overview, kind of how the state is set up is we've divided it into 6 regions. So each region has a comprehensive domestic violence program, a comprehensive sexual assault program, and then a physical brick and mortar shelter building. So when we look at our shelters and what we're seeing right now, you know, we're really following guidelines from the CDC and kind of what's being told at the state and federal level in terms of social distancing, not having groups of more than 10 in a space at one time, making sure that all communal living spaces, you know, are adequately disinfected, regulating, you know, how many people are possibly, you know, in a kitchen area or a communal living room or bathrooms, that type of stuff. We're trying right now to keep people out of the physical shelters as much as possible and move them into more emergency shelter options in hotels or motels in their community, working with landlords and community partners to see if there's some extra units that we could secure and put survivors and their families potentially in those spaces. So to keep them healthy, kind of keep them distant like we're supposed to. And if somebody, you know, is, I want to say sometimes the most vulnerable individuals who don't have anywhere else to go, that's where we're kind of holding space right now within our shelters. And this isn't anything new for us since we do run a mobile advocacy model of service delivery, creating partnerships within the community. We already had those established, so reaching out to them to say we might need to utilize them a little bit more right now, they're prepared for that.
And you've been able to secure these spaces that you need, these potential additional spaces to support social distancing.
We have. We've been really fortunate. Our programs have great relationships within their, you know, the counties that they serve, and several community partners across the state have reached out to us and said, you know, hey, I would like to, you know, reserve, you know, X number of rooms for this number of time, just in case there's an uptick and you need to utilize them as people call in. Or our programs have been able to reach out to landlords that they're working with within their communities and say, you know, we know we have maybe 2 to 3 apartments secured. Would it be possible if we needed to maybe look at 3 or 4 during this time? So people have been incredibly supportive and want to do whatever they can because we know that survivors are in an incredibly vulnerable position right now with the shelter in place order, not officially going within the state, but pretty unofficially.
Right. And let's talk about that a bit. As you mentioned, there's not a formal stay-at-home order statewide right now. There is one in place in certain parts of the states, but there's a recommendation of social distancing and limiting on group gatherings everywhere. And of course, this is a key public health choice in a lot of ways, but what risks could it pose for those who are experiencing or at risk of experiencing domestic violence?
Sure. So shelter-in-place orders, they make survivors very vulnerable during this time. We completely understand the need to have them in place to hopefully slow the curve of this pandemic, but it puts a survivor in a position where they are at home with a person who harms them for an extended period of time. Isolation is a key component of how someone controls a survivor within their home. So when you're asking people to stay in and cut off contact with the outside world, really to a sense, you're cutting off some of that support that a survivor relies on. And maybe it's through, you know, their job outside of the home, you know, they have a safety network or a little bit of community support if they've disclosed or even if they have not disclosed the abuse they're enduring at home. So we're very concerned about them. I can tell you that our advocates are very concerned with anyone that they are working with right now. We know that the numbers, which is surprising to the general public, are down right now, but that isn't really that's what we would expect it to be, because access to working with, you know, whether it's their advocate or just their support system outside of the home has been limited. So finding the time to maybe, you know, make a phone call to an advocate or their local program, or being able to leave the house and, you know, find some distance from the person who's harming them. That's really difficult right now. And we understand that survivors are in a very vulnerable position.
Right. So what I understand you're saying is it's not necessarily that instances of domestic violence or intimate partner violence are down. It's simply that it might be more difficult to report at this moment.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, we're going to have to wait and kind of see. I think that probably over the next month, maybe 5 weeks, we'll really kind of see if there's an uptick as restrictions start to be loosened across the state, but also across the country. I think we'll definitely see the uptick in the number of calls and the number of outreach that is going to be put out to our programs. But no, I don't want to give the impression at all that during this time, domestic violence by any means is slowing down. It's just that access to resources is limited.
So when it comes to offering those resources and that support, especially in communities, perhaps more rural communities, where it's already a little more difficult to get to areas where offices and physical support spaces might be, what are you doing in your partner organizations to make support and services available in this time?
You know, what we're doing is we're, you know, one, making sure everyone knows that our services are still here. We do not want to give the impression with so many things shutting down that any of our services have shut down, because that's not the case. They may have changed a little bit. Instead of possibly, you know, meeting with clients face to face on, you know, a regular basis like our advocates have in the past, it might be done a little bit more through text messaging or through phone calls. We're asking survivors, you know, to kind of, when they're thinking about a safety plan and they're kind of thinking about this shelter in place, identifying, you know, what are the things that are going to make them more vulnerable right now? Are there ways that they could still reach out to, you know, colleagues via email, since so many people are working from home, just to, you know, kind of do like a daily check-in? You know, is there someone in their inner circle that they trust that they could reach out to, just to maybe, you know, even if they have to code something because the person who's harming them is kind of monitoring all of their electronic history that's going on, you know, just to kind of say, you know, how was your weekend? How was the weather? Mine was good. I'm doing okay here. What areas of their home can they identify as safe right now? What are some areas of the home they want to stay out of, you know, because that is a little bit more dangerous for them? Are there some things that they could put into place or kind of know the patterns of the person who harms them to try and mitigate that as much as possible? What are some opportunities that they would be able to be outside of the home or be away from an abuser, you know, whether it's running to the grocery store or having to get some of those essential products somewhere? Is there a time for them to get out and make a phone call just to check in with somebody? So there isn't really an answer, a perfect answer, and we wish that there was for this. But what I, you know, what I would say and what our advocates would say is, you know, we know a survivor understands what is best for them and what is going to keep them safe. And our advocates will do anything that they possibly can to help with that, even with these social distancing guidelines.
There's a 24/7 crisis hotline available. Tell us a little bit about that and give us the number if someone could be in need of using that support.
Yes, we have a 24/7 statewide hotline available. It's called the Iowa Victim Service Call Center. It is housed and operated by one of our programs up in Northwest Iowa. And advocates are available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and can go over anyone's situation, assess what needs they need met right now, connect them with the advocate in their community, and they're ready, willing, and able to help at any time. And their toll-free number is 1-800-770-1650. Or someone can text Iowa Help to 20121. And All calls are confidential. We encourage not only survivors to reach out, but if you're someone who is concerned about a friend or coworker or family member who is sheltering in place right now and might be in an unsafe situation, to also call, because we are here to support you as well and maybe give you some guidance on how you can help that person in your life that's experiencing violence.
Again, that number is 800-770-1650 or text Iowa Help to 20121. Lindsay Pingle, Director of Community Engagement for the Iowa Coalition Against Domestic Violence. Lindsay, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Caitlin.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Caitlin Harrop, in for Ben Kiefer. The COVID-19 pandemic is changing the face of voting and elections across the country. 15 states, including Indiana, Ohio, and Virginia, have postponed their Democratic presidential primary elections, and yesterday, New York announced that they're canceling theirs altogether. Iowa's February caucuses happened before social distancing recommendations went into effect, but there's no way to know what recommendations will be in place when the next primary election day hits the state on June 2nd. Major U.S. Senate and House seats are up for grabs, as well as several spots in the state legislature. Secretary of State Paul Pate and county officials across the state are working to adapt to what could be an election day unlike any other, with a new emphasis on voting by mail. Joel Miller, Linn County Auditor and Commissioner of Elections, is with me today to share one county's perspective on this new voting reality. He's on the line now. Hello, Joel.
Hello.
Thanks for joining us today. And you're encouraging voters in your county to vote from home ahead of the June 2nd primary date. Why did you consider this to be an important step to take?
Well, it just seemed like the thing to do. There was a lot of activity with a lot of conversations going on between the auditors and the Secretary of State. And I know a lot of my peers were pushing for vote by mail in the state. And that's based on the information we had at the time, which was information back in the February time frame. So it certainly we have a lot more information now, but I don't think that the risk has changed, especially in Linn County. And I think we headed down the road of trying to encourage people to vote at home to protect the voters as well as protect the precinct election officials.
Right. And your office has received over 12,000 absentee requests. That was the latest number I have. And that's up from over 1,500 requests in the 2018 primary. So that's very significant. What's the process like for working through these requests and getting ballots out to voters?
Well, actually, we're up to 15,000 requests, wow, which is more people, more voters than we had vote in the 2016 presidential primary. So that's a good thing. Certainly, we didn't know what the response rate would be, and I'm overjoyed with that kind of response. It certainly should lessen the number of people driving up for curbside voting or coming to the polls on election day. So we're happy about that. And we're on track to potentially eclipse the total votes. Well, that is more than the total to voted right now in 2016 and getting close to what we voted in 2018 as well.
Once a voter receives their ballot in Linn County or in any other county, what is the process like to vote from home? What does a voter need to do?
Well, we mailed out absentee ballot request forms to every household. And by the way, there's another mailing in Linn County coming from the Secretary of State. I see it's in my informed delivery via the United States Postal Service that it's coming in. It's on its way today. So you'll have a second opportunity. That mailing by the Secretary of State is going to every registered voter in the state. So if you have not already filled out the one from us, and I'm glad that we got ahead of this curve, and we're not fighting for resources with all the other counties, then mail this one in, and we will receive it. We will process it. We will, based upon the selection you made, whether you receive a Democratic ballot or Republican ballot, we will send that particular ballot out for your voting location to you. That'll come in a large envelope, but it'll be readily identifiable, and it'll be from my office. and then fill it out, hopefully fill it out in a timely manner and get it back to us. The last thing we want is to have sent a lot of ballots out to people and then not get them returned for us. That leads to other claims that we don't want to have to deal with. So we want all the ballots back that we send out.
And postage is included on those. Is that correct?
And postage is included both ways. Yes, we send the postage out. It's a prepaid envelope to receive the absentee ballot in return. And then we reprocess it. There's actually a tracking site on the Secretary of State's website where you can track your ballot from the time it's sent out to the time we receive it back. So you can kind of track through the process to see what's going on.
In Linn County, and that notably includes Cedar Rapids as a large metro area, absentee voting will be available in person as an early voting option through something of a drive-through process. Tell us what that's going to look like.
Well, we did not want to take a chance on being able to. We didn't know if our building, the Public Service Center, will be open to the public by then. So we didn't want to open up a voting and have that the only activity going on to the building. It would lead people to believe that there's other things going on there as well. So we're actually going to have a curbside drive-up voting place at 823 3rd Street Southwest in Cedar Rapids, which is just about a half a block away from the Public Service Building. It's across the railroad tracks from us. So we looked at whether or not we could handle people inside the building that were going to have it there, and then kind of evaluated the social distancing required, the sanitation that was going to happen. And we already had to offer by state law, and we offer this every election, curbside voting. So I just made the decision that we're just going to do curbside for everyone. That way everyone's treated the same. Anyone can drive up, and people just stay in their car. We will have a two-person team come out to the car, take the information, go back, get the ballot for that particular voter or voters. Whoever's in the car, can be more than one, can be two or three or four people in there, assuming it's a family unit or people living together. Mm-hmm. And then we bring the ballot out to them, they'll vote it, and give it back to us.
As of now, on Election Day, voters in Linn County will still have the option to vote in person, but you're restricting that to polling to just 19 sites, and that, to give some perspective, you've had more than 80 polling sites available in recent elections. So this is particularly important to note because some voters may have a temporary voting location that's different from where they usually vote, correct?
Correct.
Okay.
We will. We have 86 precincts in Linn County, and we are going to consolidate those, combine many of those precincts down to 19 physical polling locations. I think all but one of those is in a government building. So the polls will be open at 7 a.m. to 9 p.m. on that day, and we will send out a postcard to every voter, basically advising where their polling place will be, where this polling place for the June 2nd primary election will be. So hopefully that alleviates the confusion. We're not required to send that out. Surprisingly, in state law, we're not required to send out these notices, but I felt it was necessary to do, and we will be doing it to ensure that people end up in the right place if they choose to go to the polls.
In just about a minute that we have left here, as we mentioned previously, the Secretary of State's office is sending out or has sent out absentee ballot request forms. But if a voter in Linn County or anywhere else hasn't received an absentee ballot request form or have another question about voting absentee, who should they get in touch with?
Well, they should call their local county auditor and commissioner of elections, just like myself. There's 98 other people just like me, fully capable of answering questions.
And before we go today, Joel, when are absentee ballots due for this June primary?
They are due to be they need to be postmarked on June 1st. So if they're not postmarked to us on June 1st, then you need to bring it to us physically. And unfortunately, we don't encourage that. Bring them physically to our office or turn them in at the polling place when you go to vote. So you can take that absentee ballot to the polling place, turn it in. They will issue a new ballot to vote on Election Day. But certainly we're trying to keep the social distancing, keep everyone safe, and we'd encourage you to mail it. Just mail it back. The postage is paid. That's the safest, secure thing to do.
Okay. Joel Miller, Linn County Auditor and Commissioner of Elections, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you very much. Appreciate the invitation.
And that will do it for our show today. River to River is produced by Rick Brewer and Matt Alvarez. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. If you have a question or comment for our team, you can send an email to rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. You can also follow the whole IPR crew on Twitter at Iowa Public Radio. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Caitlin Harrop. Thanks for joining us.